You're listening to the WTA Insider Podcast. Ready? Play.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the WTA Insider Podcast. I'm Courtney Nguyen, senior writer for WTA Insider at WTATennis.com, and I'll be your host on this podcast, where we take a closer to the players and all the action on the WTA Tour. On today's episode, I'm joined by WTA web editor David Kane, and we begin our upcoming series of podcasts previewing the 2017 season. Unfortunately, that look ahead begins with some tragic news coming out of the Czech Republic. On Tuesday morning, two-time Wimbledon champion and world number 11 Petra Kvitova was severely injured after an apparent home invasion attack in her apartment in Prostějov. Kvitova was able to defend herself from the knife attack but sustained serious lacerations to her fingers on her left hand. Doctors were able to repair the severed ligaments and nerves in her hand after nearly 4 hours of surgery on Tuesday, but she will be in a cast for the next 6 to 8 weeks and will be unable to put any weight on her left hand for the next 3 months. More details will be coming in the next few days, but for now, Kvitova has asked for privacy as she recovers. But it was definitely shocking news, David, to wake up to here in the States. You know, the sport angle is, of course, that, Kvitova, who finished the season so strongly in 2016, will obviously be off the table for what looks like a good amount of 2017. And hopefully the healing of that left hand. Obviously, she's a left-handed player, so it's an important hand to heal for her tennis skills. But hopefully that healing does happen quickly and we're able to see her during the 2017 season. But, you know, stepping aside and apart from the tennis, shocking. I'm still reeling, to be quite honest. Shocking news from a player who's so incredibly well-liked, who's so kind and has just such a gentle spirit to kind of know that she's had to kind of, endure such an attack it's a really tough thing to kind of reconcile.
I think the devil is really in the details. I mean, the more you heard about the story as it unfolded throughout the day, the more traumatic it sounded as a reader. I mean, hearing that the injuries were largely sustained on her left hand, I mean, it's like hearing, sort of a virtuoso violinist, has suffered a hand injury. It's that same sort of, but you need that to hit the ball, for all the injuries players have throughout their lives, they very rarely encounter something so crucial and potentially something so career ending in terms of a hand injury and the circumstances in which the injuries occurred, an ostensibly, random attack, the intruder not knowing who Petra even was, and Petra on one leg already dealing with a foot injury in a cast.
Yeah, she had a cast, on her right leg. One leg, she fights off a knife-wielding attacker.
In one way, it's just a very strong statement, on behalf of the women who make up the WTA, just how tough they are and how when their backs are up against the wall, quite literally in their apartments, just going about their day, that they're able to fight off what seemed to quite literally be a life or death situation. And so in that respect, I think, as bad as it sounds like it could have been a lot worse. And in this sort of circumstance, you kind of have to take 2017 off the table and just be so grateful and thankful that a person who has been so much a part of the tennis world over the last, 6 or 7 years is okay, overcame what was really perhaps the greatest adversity of 2016. For as much as we talk about tennis, I think, we all have to, this really does put things in perspective, results and rankings and everything like that, that in which she seems to have been very lucky to have made it out of.
Most definitely. And I think that you saw immediately, if you were following the news on Twitter and following things on the day, on Tuesday, just the outpouring of kind of support and affection from the tennis community with respect to Petra Kvitova. She's, you don't win the WTA Sportsmanship Award 4 years running, 5 of the last 6 years, randomly. You do it because, your colleagues genuinely respect you, genuinely consider you a fair person, a nice person. And, that goes a long way. And so, again, that just kind of magnifies it makes everything a little bit even, more jarring She's just such an incredibly humble person, you know, living in her, you know, single apartment in Prostyov during the off season, you know, doesn't think twice about it. You know, there are people who are thinking, oh, where's the security? Where's this and that? That's just not who Petra Kvitova is. as one who knows her, she's just a very grounded, doesn't think she's a big deal, you know, kind of person. And just as you said, David, that she was able to survive the attack, and you're right, it could have been much worse. And that was what was one of the clear messages, as I was spending most of the day trying to get, you know, further detail on what had happened and be able to report on it. That was one of the really big key takeaways, from speaking with her agent and speaking with her publicist, is that this could have been much worse, and that Petra Kvitova saved her own life, with how she defended herself there. So we hope to see her back on the court again, but for right now, we just hope that she's able to recover. That she has her family around her, and yeah, we'll be waiting for you, Petra, you know, with open arms. That's for darn sure.
To take the tennis tack just for a moment, it is very sad given how strongly she finished the 2016 season. Obviously, Courtney, you've spent a lot of time with Petra on the tour throughout the last several years. I got to spend a week with her spend a lot of time speaking with her in Zhuhai, which she ended up winning without dropping a set, and was really just in a great mood, was hitting the ball very well, felt like she had overcome a lot in 2016, personally, professionally, splitting with her longtime coach, David Katiz, at the beginning of the season, ending in engagements, and then really kind of seeing things come together for her at the Olympics, such a strong fall swing, beating Angelique Kerber in what the fans voted as one of the best matches of 2016 in Wuhan, and then winning the title in Zhuhai, finishing the season at number 11 and looking kind of poised to make another run up the rankings. And even with little niggles and injuries here and there in the offseason with a foot injury, I mean, right before this happened, she tweeted out that she wouldn't be at Hopman Cup because of another injury. And so, you know, it's just, it's disappointing to see such great talent, you know, have to continually come up against difficulty. And certainly this is the most difficult thing that she's had to come across thus far in her life and her career. And as you said, someone who is so kind and so genuine and just, you know, just a normal person doing her job on a daily basis. And her job just happens to really showcase a tremendous amount of talent.
You know, our hearts and our thoughts are with Petra and her family right now. And we hope to see her, you know, smiling and cracking those jokes and falling asleep at the dais and, you know, all that good stuff, all the stuff that make her an incredibly endearing person to have on tour. It's going to be a little bit emptier in the bulk of 2017 without Petra's kind of easy laugh and smile and just energy on tour. But moving on to what was supposed to be the bulk of this week's episode, you know, last week, David and I looked back at the 2016 season that was, and, you know, talked about the most surprising stories, most underrated stories, best stories, et cetera, et cetera. So if you haven't listened to that episode, please go back, give it a listen. It'll entertain you for sure. But this week we're looking at the present. So we're kind of doing this Dickensian, you know, ghosts of Christmas past, Christmas present. And next week we'll be looking obviously towards 2017 specifically and looking at the future. But here for this episode, we are going to be looking at where things stand as the women of the WTA prepare to descend on Australia, New Zealand, and China for the first week of the season, which begins on January 1st. I had a bit of a panic attack the other day because I realized that in less than 10 days, I was going to be on a plane headed down under. And yeah, that was before all of the news of today. So it's been a bit of an overwhelming and too short of an off season, as you've heard us say time and time and again on the podcast. But this is the merry go round of tennis. But yeah, quite a bit has happened in the offseason. Let's start first and foremost with, you know, the primary discussion point during any offseason, which is the coaching carousel. So quite a few offseason and significant offseason coaching changes have been announced. It kind of all started with number 5, Karolina Pliskova, splitting with her coach, Jiří Vanek, and she's now hired Petra Kvitova's former coach, actually, David Kotyza, who you mentioned before, David. Madison Keys has split with with Thomas Hogstedt, and she has yet to announce a replacement coach. And Johanna Konta ended her partnership with Esteban Carril and will be teaming up with Wim Fazet, the former coach of Kim Clijsters, Simona Halep, and most recently Victoria Azarenka. Those are kind of the top level changes that we've been seeing, or at least have been announced. And obviously we might get more of a sense of where things stand for a lot of players once I get down to Brisbane, and once the season starts and the media get to grill them about what happened during the offseason. But turning it over to you, David, what was the most surprising coaching change that you saw this offseason?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there have been so many changes. It's been such a carousel. One might even call it a carousal.
one might.
In terms of coaching. But I would have to say the big, I mean, we saw a lot of this in the last couple of years in terms of players having breakthrough seasons and then switching coaches. And a lot of the surprise with that has to do with the fact that I do think a lot of the outside world puts a lot of emphasis on a new coach or even a coach as being sort of a crucial part of that player's success. Is the switch with Konta surprising? No. I mean, it's the thing about Konta that we have to look at in terms of her coaching change is not necessarily perhaps even her coach, but the unexpected and surprising death of her sports psychologist. And now Johanna Konta has risen up the rankings quite a bit in the last 18 months. And when asked how she did it and what changed for her, she hasn't given a tremendous amount of answers. You know, she's not really one who considers herself an overnight success. However, one of the things that she does look to or has looked to in terms of her rise is seeing a sports psychologist and sort of helping her mature mentally and becoming more mentally tough on the court. And so for one who had a lot of disappointments and had a lot of difficult moments at the end of the season, not, you know, narrowly missing out on qualifying for Singapore, obviously having a strong finish in Zhuhai, but then having this loss, I'm curious to see how she rebounds in 2017. Obviously, we have Wim Fazet. His reputation certainly precedes him with his really great work with Kim Clijsters, Sabine Lisicki, and Simona Halep. Certainly a great coach and one who has worked, who can definitely get players to change their mentality. And so that might be something that will really be helpful to Konta, but having to make it back out on the court in 2017 without one of those really crucial members of your team, I think that's probably more worrisome and more concerning than maybe some of the other coaching changes that happened in the periphery.
I definitely agree with kind of your read on Konta, because you're right. I mean, as someone who interviewed her consistently throughout the season, she was always really, you know, willing to give a lot of credit to the work that she had been doing with her mental coach, Juan Cotto. And, you know, it wasn't really about talking tactics or I improved my serve or, you know, my forehand down the line is working better, things like that. It was really just about her mindset and how that changed. So I think that that'll be a very interesting development going into 2017. Konta has said that, told British Press that she does intend to kind of find a new mental coach. So it's not something that she's going to just lay, you know, put to the sideline now that the man that she was working with for so long, is gone. But, you know, it's getting back to the question of whether or not these coaching changes are surprising. I always kind of go back and forth with it, because how much stock do we put into coaches? How much stock do we put into the impact that a coach has on what is the on-court product? I think that the answer to that question, like how much impact does a coach have on the on-court product, I think that that really varies from coach to coach. And I think that, you know, the quality of coaching within tennis really varies from person to person. And that's just kind of, you know, the result of a sport where, you know, this is a sport where you can designate your best friend or your sister your coach. You can designate, you know, your mom or your dad, who never played tennis in their life, your coach. Sometimes those parents are great. Sometimes maybe they should step aside. But it just really depends. Sometimes, you know, the coach that you happened to train you when you were 7 years old and stuck by you, and now you're a pro, maybe they are in over their heads on the pro level. Maybe they're great. You know, it just really depends. And maybe the pro coach that is has the fantastic resume is a terrible fit for you and is actually detrimental to your game, you know, or maybe they're great. So it's always really difficult to kind of figure that aspect of it out. So it's always hard to make those blanket statements of like, oh, it's always chaos when players fire coaches and hire new coaches, especially after breakout seasons. It's like, not really. Sometimes like their breakout season was entirely because of them and it had nothing to do with their coach. It always goes back and forth. And in 2017, as you know, David, you know, the WTA is soon to be rolling out a kind of more structured coaching program within the tour, which I'm actually quite excited about, which is kind of formalizing, you know, the standard of what is a WTA level professional coach, and in hopes of kind of creating, you know, this resource for all coaches who coach on the pro tour to kind of improve and to kind of clear a certain base level bar, so that, you know, the quality of the coaching improves, and also that you know, from the writing perspective, we get to get to know the coaches a little bit better. They become more personalities that fans know as well on tour. I think that would be really great. But, you know, in this situation, I think that the most surprising coaching split of the ones that were announced was Pliskova and Vanek. I just really got the sense that Karolina Pliskova and Jiří Vlánek really got along well, that he really had a good vibe with her. He knew how to speak to her. And he had done a tremendous amount of work to improve her, to actually tactically and technically improve her game. So that was the one that I kind of didn't see coming. The other ones, I was like, yeah, I guess I can kind of see that. But that was the one where I'm like, huh, that's interesting. But I think that, you know, David Cotiza, I can't say enough about. I mean, I think that he's a fantastic coach. So very interested to see where he takes Pliskova next year.
No, definitely. I think the default is to kind of put a lot of stock into it. But I think for me, what I try to do, I think, is look at it on a case-by-case basis. But of course, that is always going to be colored by either actual visibility of coach or perceived visibility of coach. Now, how much does the player refer to the coach, you know, in press or in interviews, or how often are they there in on-court coaching, and are they saying things that seem to be helping? I feel like, you know, at least in hardcore tennis circles, I think Vlado Platonic has kind of become sort of a legend for his on-court coaching, with Daria Kasatkina kind of giving clear, concise advice, really, and seeming to have a positive effect on her game after these coaching timeouts. And then again, when I say colored, you know, of course, with Jiří Vlánek coming on court, speaking Czech to Karolína Pliskova, it's harder to necessarily gauge how much he's helping or even who he is, because you kind of, you know, when someone is not speaking your language, you do kind of zone out a little bit. And so I didn't get the same vibe from Vanek and Pliskova. Of course, I wasn't on tour. I wasn't seeing them in practice. So I'm not going to get the same perspective. So when I heard that announcement, I didn't really feel one way or the other about it, because I didn't hear her talking about her coach as being a new presence or as being, you know, a crucial presence to her improvement. I think she credits a lot of her improvements with kind of just learning the game, and the game being the week in, week out tour life, and, you know, taking time off and not overplaying and dedicating time to fitness, if anything, more dedicating the right amount of time off the court than to on the courts, you know, from one who would play every week of the year to kind of taking that pronounced break in the middle of the summer and seeing it immediately pay off. I think that might have caused her to reevaluate how she wants to structure her team and maybe have it be more leaning towards physicality and making sure that her fitness is what it needs to be when she steps on the court. Because I think everybody knows her technique when it's on is really something to watch in terms of power and precision.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, as one who was on tour and having seen like Pliskova and Vanek interact, I think that's probably where you're right. I kind of got my sense more based off of, you know, seeing them interact at breakfast or, you know, at the player hotel, you know, and being like, oh, they seem to get along really well. That's great. And, you know, Jiří Vlánek was a little bit younger. He's younger than David Cotiza, for example. You know, a lot of players have said that sometimes that's really helpful. You know, they feel like they have somebody who they just vibe well with and they're comfortable around, and, you know, that works out well. But I think, I mean, I think Cotiza is a fantastic coach. So I think that, you know, it should be fine. What's your take, David? I don't think I've actually ever asked you this question. So this, I'm flying a little blind here. What's your take on Madison Keys when it comes to coaching? Because she is a player who's young, who's gone through a lot of coaches, and she's gone through, USTA coaches, lesser known, new coaches, whether it was Jesse Levine for a bit last year. She had Lindsay Davenport, and John Leach, which seemed to work out really, really well. But then, that split Hogstedt, it seemed like the minute that she hired Hogstedt, her results really came fast and furious. And, she just played her most consistent season of the year, but they cited differences in personality for the reason for that split. So, okay, I get that, but for a young player, that's a lot of coaches to kind of go through. I'm just kind of curious what your thought process is when it comes to Madison on that.
Yeah, in isolation, the parting with Hogstedt, I guess, isn't that surprising. But with Madison, I feel like it has started to stack up to the point where it is the question I think needs to be asked.
So obviously she made the Grand Slam semifinal at the Australian Open under Lindsay. She has her most consistent season and best season, arguably, under Hogstedt this year. When she has made coaching hires that were seemingly related to, I just get along with you, and I like you, and we're buds, whether that's Jesse Levine, Lisa Raymond, when Lisa Raymond came on and coached her a little bit, and they were, good friends. I think that in those situations, it has been a little bit, and even, back in the day when she shared coaches like Juan Todaro, when he was with the USTA and kind of shared coaches via USTA, it was casual. And I think that casualness would kind of that relationship would maybe seep into her game a little bit. I really liked when she hired Lindsay, and I really liked when she hired Hogstedt, because it felt like it was a signal of, I am a professional now. It's not about we're friends, although she got obviously along with Lindsay famously, and that coaching relationship really was more of an issue of the fact that, Lindsay has a family and can't travel full time, and Madison wanted more than that, and Lindsay couldn't give it. And that's, where it comes down to. And a lot of coaching relationships with respect to people who would be great coaches never reach fruition because of those specific reasons. I think that's why it continues to be a huge coup. If you want to talk about one of the biggest coaching coups in terms of hires of the last 5 years, Simona Halep landing Darren Cahill is massive. Because a lot of it had to do with timing, because the Adidas player development program ended, which freed up a significant amount of his time. But this is a coach who was being chased by Andy Murray, being chased by Roger Federer, being chased by Anna Ivanovic's, the Caroline Wozniacki's, all these players. And it was Simona that was able to land him, And that's been an incredibly solid partnership. Outside of that, but that's the thing, is like, I don't know, I feel like with Madison, like, kind of making that transition into, like, it's not about being friends, it's about, like, being a professional athlete. I think that actually works really well for her, whereas for other players, that's not always going to work well. Like, a Kvitova would never work. A big-name coach, like, for me, would never work with Petra, for example.
I guess with Madison, maybe I was trying to be kind, is that it would appear to me that she seems to be running out of those sort of big name coaches. I feel like there are so many that exist, and she's worked with quite a few of them at this point. I don't know. Maybe this is just like a fun and flirty game we can have. It's just like, if you could call up anyone and say, if you're representing Madison Keys, who would you pick to coach her?
Lindsay Davenport. I mean, it's as simple as that. I just think that Lindsay is the one. She's the Madison whisperer, or like a Venus. I cannot wait. I want Venus to coach so badly when she's done with tennis.
Do you think that? I don't know if she would.
Yeah, she might do something like Fed Cup captain, I think would be tremendous. But I just think
that I would say, or owning a team tennis team or something,
right? I mean, as one who shared a court with Venus Williams and was her doubles partner for a charity exhibition at the Family Circle Cup back in the day.
As a former doubles partner of Venus Williams,
a former doubles partner, and also for at least 35 minutes there.
And brand ambassador.
And brand ambassador. Hey, 11 fits well. I'm not one that can rock the tennis clothes, but I look pretty good that day. For those who don't know, I did play doubles with Venus, but she was incredibly, like, she was great as a coach, like, just tactically, of like giving me tips and being really positive and, but at the same time being firm. Like, Venus wants to win. She ain't there to boost up your ego. And it was a great experience, but I would like to see Venus Coach. But pivoting a little bit to a different question.
I will
make go ahead.
One point though, just about if we're looking for perhaps an emotional, powerful woman coach and who actually wants to do it, I think maybe we might look no further than Martina Navratilova, who I think was very disappointed that her partnership with Radvanska didn't last longer than it did. And I think maybe perhaps that might be something a little bit similar in terms of maybe even changing mentality, making Madison perhaps more competitive. I know, you know, certainly part of the Martina mythology is the mental shift that she had to make from seeing players as friends and to seeing them more as competition. That might be perhaps something that she can, she might want to look at as the list, as she goes farther down the list of A-list names and A-list coaches.
We've spent this time talking about coaching changes that have happened. But David, are there any coaching changes that didn't happen that you thought might have, or that you thought should, you know, that in terms of like players who you would like to see them switch things up or bring in somebody else or a new or fresh voice? And anybody come to mind to you?
Yeah, going down the list, I mean, when you look at the top 10 and certainly the top 20, a lot of those players are there because they had great years, and they had great years, at least somewhat in part because they had a good coaching team around them, getting them ready for matches and getting them to play consistent tennis throughout the years. I know we talked before about, you know, perhaps parents as coaches and that being, you know, either a good thing or a bad thing, a coach not necessarily having the sort of top flight experience, but because the player is so talented, it kind of makes up the difference. I mean, one relationship I would look at would perhaps be even, you know, Vesnina and her father. I mean, that's a team that's been together for her whole career. You know, Elena gives a lot of credit to her dad being so supportive and really not looking at it as anything other than this is something that makes my daughter happy. And all I want is for you to be happy. And I don't want you to work out. You know, she even joked that, you know, during practice sessions that her father will say that she's overexerting herself and she's, you know, stressing herself out too much and she shouldn't worry so much. And that's, you know, totally fine. It's something that worked for her, got her up to a career high ranking. She does seem to be someone, based on our conversations, to be a player who wants to work on getting to that next step and perhaps getting to the top 10. And I would be curious to see what a new voice in her team might bring. You know, that might be just something. I know even when I spoke to Yulia Putintseva, this is just my greatest hits at this point, but when I spoke to Yulia at the US Open, you know, about, she was a player who worked with her father her whole career and sort of slowly shifted away from being with him all the time to then working with a hitting partner who is now her coach, Yuri Kislansky, who's young and seems to really get her. You know, some of their coaching timeouts in Charleston were very amusing when she was getting very upset about the wind, and it was just very fun. But seeing kind of that shift and sort of that maturity but sort of cutting off the training wheels a little bit and feeling like to get to the next step, I need to have this sort of third party to motivate me and this voice that isn't so close that's going to tell me the things I need to hear, was certainly encouraging to hear from a young player, especially one who had worked so closely with a family member for most of her career. And in that same vein, Caroline Garcia, who's had a really close coaching relationship with her father, I'd be curious. I think a lot of people, when they think of Caroline, they think of Amelie Mauresmo, Fed Cup captain. And a lot of people have pointed to Caroline's best results coming in Fed Cup when she cannot use outside coaching and has to work with a Fed Cup coach, who was Amelie, who she had to work with as throughout her tenure as Fed Cup captain. And so I think a lot of people would be dying to see what that coaching relationship would be like. But yeah, I think that's, you know, again, maybe that's just a bias, you know, growing up watching Martina Hingis be coached by her mom and watching a lot of those old matches as a kid and hearing the commentators be very encouraging that perhaps she get another voice and that working with a parent for so long might not necessarily be the best thing. You know, then of course the counter argument would be, you know, the Williams family, but then again, they've always had hitting partners, they've had coaches. So there always has been a sort of balance you know, with that. I mean, obviously, if you look for the standard, I would look no further than, you know, whatever Serena Williams is doing. I think you might want to look at that as perhaps being a model to emulate. But yeah, I think those are probably the few relationships that I might want to reevaluate. But again, they had such great results in 2016 that I wouldn't say there's anything. I wouldn't look at this list and say there's any dire need to see a player split from their current situation.
Yeah, the only player that stands out to me in the top 20 as being a player who this isn't to say that I want to see them split with their coach. It's more to say that I'm curious to see or to know what perhaps a different voice would, how that would impact their game. The only one that stands out to me is Radwanska. I think that she's obviously had a very successful long-term coaching partnership with Tomas Vigorovsky, who's fantastic. I think that they get along together. I think that Aga also at this point, she's not a young buck anymore. She knows her game. She knows what she needs to do out there. A voice at this point to come in, they're not going to change tactics. They're not going to change technique. It's just going to be a few pointers here or there. So maybe that's why if you're Radwanska, you look at it and you say, there's no point in bringing in a new voice, you know, like, I know exactly what I need to do. I just need to do it. But that is one where that is a longstanding coaching relationship that has not really been shaken up for a very long time. I don't remember when it became formalized because obviously Aga had been coached by her father for much of her young career. But Vitkorovsky kind of took over, I want to say about 6 years ago?
2011. It was right around the time she got the lotto sponsorship. Okay. Yeah.
So 5 years ago. And yeah, so, you know, after 5 years, one would think that one would revisit, you know, is this the best, situation for me? That being said, she's had, you know, in a lot of ways you could see Radwanska looking at her last, for example, 3 years and being like, this is great. I mean, you know, like I'm finishing in the top five the last couple of years. I'm getting good results. Are they consistent? No, it's kind of spurt to spurt. I haven't been able to do what I want to do at Wimbledon, so I'm a little bit disappointed in that. But maybe I think, you know what, give me one more shot. Give me one more, you know, something just went horribly wrong last year. I ran up against Domenica Sabolkova, who knew, at Wimbledon, et cetera, et cetera. So, but that's probably the one coaching relationship in the top 20 that I would say, I'm curious to see, you know, what would happen if a new voice was there. I mean, the other one that I suppose would also say is probably Wozniacki at 19. Just because, again, not to say that obviously her father has been a great coach in terms of getting her to number one and putting her in a position to succeed. I'm always curious to know what would a Caroline Wozniacki under outside coaching look like. Would she play different? Would she be willing to play different? I don't know what the answer is to that, but for now we won't know because as we always, as she has always made clear, she likes being coached by her father. She thinks that that's the best arrangement to get the best tennis out of her. And so I don't anticipate that changing anytime soon. But those are the two players that stand out to me.
I mean, it's interesting because working with another player who worked with her father for a very long time, I think to the point where a lot of people were wondering if that relationship would ever change because they were together. It seemed like such a long time, you know, in retrospect, she was kind of on everyone's radar for about 3 to 4 years when the change finally happened. And of course, that seemed like an eternity for us in the tennis world, feeling like they would never split. And then she did. And she's really kind of stuck with her current setup through the slight foray into working with Martina Navratilova for a few months. It's true. I think Aga's game is so unique that, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, what does one add to the Radwanska game? It's just funny to imagine a coach coming in, encouraging her to, you know, have you ever thought of adding more variety to your game? There are some technical things I would be curious to see if they could change some things, like, for example, you know, how she absorbs pace, perhaps, you know, yeah, you know, I know she said she feels comfortable kind of absorbing it and, you know, and I was going to say getting down on one knee, but I don't, you know, it just seems like it's a weird thing to describe. She kind of just looks like she's just like taking the impact of a wrecking ball. I mean, with Aga, what I have noticed is that she does inject more pace into rallies and that certainly rewards her. She's winning these rallies, not just because she's consistent, but because she is finding opportunities a lot of times on her backhand, injecting pace. And it does throw the opponent off and it does allow her to kind of do what she does best, as it were. You know, it's kind of a, it's sort of a forgettable shot in the midst of a rally for a Radwanska, but it's one that I've noticed where it really does change the course of the rally, and it does allow her to do the things that she's voted shot, you know, shot of the year over and over and over again.
She's a far more aggressive player now
than anyone would give her credit for.
2 years ago than she was 5 years ago. I mean, the improvements have been night and day. And I think that that's one reason why I would like to see her get the success, like, you know, the results to kind of
back that up.
Exactly. To rubber stamp that, to basically encourage her to continue to do that. Yeah, I would like to see the changes that she's made in her game rewarded, because I think that those are the changes that, like, needed to be made. And that should be a signal to other players. Like, you need to find ways within your game style to be aggressive. Well, we spent the bulk of the episode talking about coaching changes and the coaching carousel and coaching as a concept, but there's a couple of other stories that I wanted to touch on a little bit that kind of came up during the offseason. The first, obviously, congratulations to Victoria Azarenka, who has given birth to a healthy baby boy, which happened this week on Tuesday morning, which is just tremendous. And so, yeah, Vika's a mom, which is great. And I don't know, David, I mean, do you think that we're going to see her in 2017? This is the big question that is on many people's minds.
No. I mean, maybe at the very end of the year, like kind of like when Justine came back, she came back like in December and like an XO, and then maybe like kickstarted it January 2018. But I think, you know, I think the longer this pregnancy has gone, the more Vika has gotten into the idea of being a mom, you know, and kind of enjoying that process and enjoying that space in her life. And it might just create a new set of goals, a new sphere for her, because up until she left the tour, tennis was all she knew and tennis was all she had. And now she has something else, you know, in her life that's, I'm imagining, going to take, and rightfully so, a tremendous amount of precedence. You know, it's going to be about raising this new baby. And there was something about her initial announcement that seemed almost clinical, you know, that she would have the baby and get right back on the court and get right back on the tour. And I think a lot of people kind of hung on to that and were, in some ways, because this is a world of athletics, very impressed at that sort of dedication. And I think reality started to set in for her. Certainly in the video, as I discussed last week, it seemed like she was kind of getting a different perspective as to what she wants to do in the immediate future. And so I don't see her back in 2017. And I'm wondering at what point we draw the line in terms of when we start to see her either planning to come back or perhaps just reevaluating what she wants out of life and how she sees herself going forward.
Yeah, no, I would definitely agree with you. I think that the calls for you know, anticipation for a speedy return from Victoria Azarenka kind of, I think, yeah, you know, I mean, I think that that's adorable. I mean, we would love to see her back. Obviously, Victoria Azarenka being one of the biggest stories of 2016 before she went off tour, but yeah, it's gonna take some time, as it should, and she should take all the time that she needs.
Yeah, and
well deserved, and she's still young, and she's still really good at tennis. Tennis players can play for much longer now. So the idea that you need to build everything into your 20s, into your early 20s, to maximize and do all these sorts of things, I don't think that's the case anymore. And so she doesn't necessarily have the pressure at this point in her life that she may have had if she were in the same position 10 years ago on the WTA, or 20 years ago, where it'd be like, yeah, your career's done. The other topic I wanted to discuss was Serena Williams. Serena, who thankfully, and I think to much the relief of many of her fans, posted a video this last week of her, you know, after a training session. So yes, Serena Williams, despite all of her, you know, social engagements that she is also engaging in, that she is on the court, she is practicing, she is remaining, you know, working on her fitness, preparing for the 2017 season. So that's great. But I don't know if everybody saw it or if people were able to see it, but Serena also sat down for a 1-hour very lengthy conversation with her good friend, rapper Common, for a television interview for ESPN on behalf of the website The Undefeated, which is ESPN's new, relatively new, website that discusses race and social issues as well, and how that, all that interacts with sport. So I thought that it was a great interview. I think that if you get a chance to watch it, you should. You can see it at the Undefeated website, undefeated.com, in different parts. It doesn't touch so – I mean, it touches on tennis, but a lot of it is about, you know, just what it was like for Serena to grow up within the tennis world, to kind of break the mold in many different ways, and to realize that she stood out, that she was, you know, it was rare to see an African-American player or a Black player that was as vocal and spoke the way and acted the way that she and her sister did, and how that was misinterpreted by the tennis community. She talks about, you know, why she's become a little bit more vocal in recent years, with respect to kind of causes that are close to her heart, that you know, may be political in nature. But there's a lot going on. But David, I know you watched the video, or I'm sorry, the interview as well. What was your big takeaway from it? Because I thought it was there was a lot to digest in that 1 hour sit down.
Yeah, it wasn't just a great interview. I think it was a really great program in all. I think it was really inspiring and really puts into perspective, I think, for sort of the insular blinders on tennis person to kind of step back and see all of the young girls that Serena has inspired, you know, getting to see, you know, girls 12, 13, 15 years old who are inspired to play tennis. And they said because they saw Serena doing it, and, you know, kind of that, and this, there was a great spoken word piece in the middle about what it means to be a role model, and how Serena sort of rides this line of being aspirational, but also being so down to earth in other ways that she's kind of the perfect role model in some ways for those who she influences and inspires. But yeah, she covered a lot of, you know, interesting topics with Common, and a lot of things that I've always been curious to ask her about. So thanks a lot, Common, for stepping in on that one. But I mean, it particularly struck me at the U.S. Open, which is where Nike unveiled the greatest athlete ever marketing campaign directed at Serena. And there was much ado about the diction and the word choice with the sort of conspicuous absence of the word female, and sort of creating this universal title for Serena and this universal mantle for Serena to take on. And that being something sort of controversial, because there was something that had never been done before. And for it to be 2016 and for it to be such a revelatory statement to say that a female athlete could be the best athlete, man or woman, you know, sort of makes us ask questions about our own society, and something that has not gone unnoticed by Serena, you know, who kind of pointedly said that if I was a man 6 or 7 years ago, and that puts her at around 12 or 13 slams, she would have already been considered to be one of the greatest of all time, or in the conversation, be the greatest of all time. And for her to have to get to 22 to match Stephanie Graf and now be in position to pass her, to be even remotely considered in the conversation of greatest of all time, when we've seen the athleticism, we've seen how she's changed the game, we've seen how she's influenced pop culture, which I thought was very interesting, the way she talked about using fashion to integrate pop culture into the sport, and what a pop culture icon she truly is. Again, something that I don't feel we in the tennis world truly appreciate, the sort of household name that Serena is. When you Google Serena, everyone knows who you're talking about. And when you Google Madison's last name, you just get a picture of keys, you know, and which I've done, because I think that I'm only thinking of one keys. And that's the other thing, that Serena is so willing to defer to Venus, and the way she talks about Venus is being her own inspiration and her own role model, and it being this sort of family tie, which I think is very which is just such a great thing, because again, I do think in some ways Venus does get lost in the mythology of Serena sometimes, and the way that Serena is so consistent in giving credit to Venus as being her own role model and her the presence in her life as being her own inspiration, I think was great. And just in all, I think, you know, they covered a lot of topics that don't get covered in the press room, and it gave fans and it gave members of the media and perhaps other players just a deeper insight into Serena. And for someone who is, again, so crucial to the zeitgeist, be it tennis or otherwise, I think it was a really great opportunity for everybody to just get one more opportunity to really appreciate what the tennis world has right now. Really the one of the greatest, certainly the greatest female athlete, and certainly one of the greatest athletes, period, in my opinion.
Most definitely. And I think that, you know, again, when you talk about, you know, Serena, you know, obviously the only piece of press that tennis players have to do that is mandatory and this only happens at tournaments. It's not mandatory for them to do press outside of events, but their only mandatory press obligation is post-match. Whether they win or lose, there is a rule in the rule book that requires both on the men's side, on the ATP and the women's side, that they do have to come to press conferences. Now, within that press conference, there's only so much you can ask. I mean, you know, if you want a deep, you know, if you want a player to reflect deeply on something, on a topic that isn't related to forehands and backhands on match point of the match that they just played, but their thoughts on something broader, a lot of times those questions have to be asked in a different setting. They have to be asked in a one-on-one that you request, which has to be granted by the player. It's not mandatory that they do a one-on-one. So what was so great about the interview, all that is to say, what is so great about the interview with Common is that he did, like you said, he did get to kind of break down and discuss and really dive into topics that for those of us who are tennis reporters, who are beat reporters, don't necessarily get to dive into with her. Because, you know, if she just beat somebody 6-love 6-2 in the third round of the U.S. Open, you're not going to sit there really and trying to drive in questions about race and about legacy. I mean, that's just not the venue for it. Serena Williams is not concerned about those things at that moment. What Serena Williams is concerned about is, I just won a third round match and I'm about to play a fourth round match. That's it. And, you know, she's in game mode. So that's where those sorts of interviews are really, you know, that's why I like watching them, you know, because it's like, oh, you got to spend this time and you have this relationship with this player where you can ask these questions and she trusts you and she's willing to go there and she's willing to ask, you know, to answer them and to dialogue with you. So I thought it was a great interview. And I think it showed a different side of Serena, a more mature, you know, side of her, and just kind of opening up and giving people insight into how she thinks about, you know, these sorts of things and these sorts of hot topic issues that are going to remain hot topic going forward. So it's a huge benefit, I think, to tennis and to fans that the interview was done. And thankfully, it wasn't just like, oh, Serena did a fluff interview for an hour. I mean, these were really solid questions and she was engaged.
It was interesting to hear Serena and Common compare their experiences with race and racism, and how comparing Serena's journey to getting more involved, posting her statements, you know, about speaking to her nephew and sort of seeing things differently or experiencing things differently as a woman versus Common's experiences as a Black man. And then talking about the idea of representation, which is so crucial for every minority, and just, you know, talking about how before Venus and Serena, there were no consistent African-American forces in tennis. I mean, of course, you had Althea Gibson, as they referenced, and Arthur Ashe, even Zena Garrison, Lori McNeil. But there wasn't this dominant force at the top of the game that the young girls who were in this program, for example, to look up to and say, I want to be just like that person. You know, I see myself in that person.
Yeah, Simone Biles, the gymnast, meeting Simone Manuel, the swimmer, who African-American swimmer who became the first African-American to win a gold medal this summer at Rio in swimming. Simone Biles, fantastic. Gabby Douglas, and meeting them and realizing that these young Black athletes, these young women, who I think one of the fun kind of cute moments from the interview is when Serena kind of says, like, you know, Common asks her, you know, do you ever feel like you should give these women advice? Not just to like Simone Manuel and Simone Biles, but even I think that he means just young African-American female athletes. And she says, yeah, but I don't know if it's really my place. And then she says, you know, but the thing is, like, these women are so well-spoken. Like, they get it. They know. They're so much smarter than I was, like, you know, at that stage. And it does make you kind of step back and realize, like, you know, as someone who grew up watching Serena and Venus throughout their entire careers from teenagers until now being obviously, you know, mid to late 30s women. When they were young, they didn't have a template. They just didn't at all. And then they said what they said and it was misinterpreted. And, you know, and tennis had to change as well. To understand where they are coming from. But, you know, when you look at like the Madison Keyses and, you know, the Sloane Stephenses within women's tennis and, you know, yeah. And you look at like Simone Biles and Simone Manuel and all these players or athletes. Yeah, you can see kind of Serena being like, I don't need to give these women advice. Like they seem to know what's going on. Like, it's okay, which I thought was
She said she didn't want to feel like mom, which I thought was very funny. Right.
But yeah, so if you get a chance, definitely pull up the Serena interviews. I think that it's a nice kind of off-season opportunity to kind of reconnect with Serena with respect to where she is right now. And I think that, you know, this is a player who hasn't played since September. So, and we really haven't heard from since September, which was... what, like 3 months ago. So it's a great opportunity. I highly recommend it. And that's a wrap on this episode of the WTA Insider Podcast. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, or on any podcast app of your choice to ensure you never miss an episode when they go live. Reviews are always helpful, so if you like what you heard so far, please do leave us one. You can also get new episode alerts by following us on Twitter at WTA_insider. And we'll, of course, post the podcast on the WTA website at WTATennis.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.